I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is the Marketplace Weekend Podcast for the weekend of January 23rd, 2015. Take the leap. Look before you leap. Leap of faith. Our vernacular is filled with the language of leaping. Maybe because having hope and taking chances are somehow a key part of being human. Or maybe because being resilient in the face of bad news or a rough economy requires jumping, no matter what. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy collides with real life. This week, if you haven't already guessed, we are talking about leaps. The kind of action that propelled you somewhere you'd always dreamed, or perhaps somewhere unexpected. Maybe even that leap not taken, and wow, are you so glad. These past few weeks, we've been getting great stories from listeners, and we're putting them on the show. So come tell us about your leaps. You can reach us on our website, marketplaceweekend.org, Marketplace's Facebook page, or on Twitter. We're at MarketplaceWKND. And to flog the metaphor a little more, let's leap into the show. We're going to start the show with a leap that the United States hasn't really taken yet, and is arguably one that's necessary for our economy to really come back. And that leap is to a place where what we get paid for what we do is actually growing. Median household income in the U.S. is lower now than it was 15 years ago. And despite creating more jobs, wages are still flat. Over the last year, the average hourly wage only rose 40 cents. So how do we make that leap as a country? Heather Boucher is the executive director at the Washington Center for Equitable Growth, and I asked her, what should we do?
There isn't just one magic bullet. There's a lot of different things we need to do. It took us a long time to get to a place where we've seen the kinds of wage stagnation that we see today. And it's going to take us a long time and a number of discrete steps to move forward. So first, we have to get our economy back to full employment. If you want people to leap, you need them to have something to leap into.
How would you define full employment?
I would define full employment by getting back to a place where the share of people with a job is closer to where it was in the late 1990s than it is today.
A lot of these things are ideas that have been talked about for a long time, certainly, I would say, by the group of progressive economists to which you belong. So it doesn't feel like there's any real movement to push that stuff forward.
So one big thing has changed. It used to be that there wasn't a lot of economic evidence that the things that we do to reduce inequality and strengthen the middle class are actually good for the total economy. But there is a growing, vibrant body of economic evidence that is making that argument. And you're seeing it come from the most unlikely of sources. You're seeing it come from the International Monetary Fund, from the World Bank. You're seeing arguments being made that this rising inequality that we've seen and the lack of really focusing on a strong middle class is having these negative implications for our broader economy. To grow our economy, we can't let all of the gains of our very, very wealthy country go to just a few at the top. That, I mean, most importantly, that stymies entrepreneurship, but it also distorts the economy in real ways. It means we're not seeing the kinds of productive investments we need to see because you're not seeing that money flow throughout the whole economy. You're seeing it sort of trapped in just a small group of people.
The president in his State of the Union used this phrase, middle-class economics. I mean, he more or less made that up. So what's the actual economic evidence that growing the middle class is the best policy focus for the economy overall?
There's a series of new and interesting papers that get at this question from the economics literature. Let me tell you just about one from the International Monetary Fund. They have some economists there that have looked at all sorts of countries and have found that countries that have less inequality have better economic growth, and that, in fact, policies that redistribute income within the country actually don't have any negative effect on growth for the most part. So basically, that study is one of many that I could point you to that underpin the president's argument that it is the middle class that helps push our economy forward. We know that the squeeze that we've seen here in the United States has not only not been good for the middle class, it hasn't been good for our economy overall.
Well, but if you look at, say, the stock market or corporate profits, both of those are doing very well.
Well, and that's not the whole economy, right? I mean, when you say that the stock market is doing well, certainly that means that investors are doing well. But most of that wealth is going to the people at the very, very top of the income distribution. If you think that that's all that the economy is, well, then that may be a good indicator. But the economy is the over 300 million people that live here in the United States. And we need measures that actually indicate how good the economy is working for all of us.
So if you think about this in two ways, you know, on the one hand, the government can give things to the middle class, tax breaks, health care, et cetera. The other part of that equation, though, is hiring and basically getting the economy to create better paying jobs. That's much harder. And it seems like fundamentally more important in a capitalist economy. So how do you do that? We're creating jobs, but how do you get them to pay better?
So the key to getting better paid jobs is first to make sure that most people who want a job can get one. Second, the government can play a very important role by leveling the playing field and setting a floor for different kinds of wages and benefits. Things like setting a minimum wage that actually is a real minimum for today's workers, hasn't been eroded by inflation as we've seen in recent years. Or laying out rules around benefits, around retirement programs or paid sick days or paid family leaves, these kinds of benefits that can make sure that everybody can keep that job once they find it. That'll help to boost individuals' wages over a lifetime. These are all, they're indirect, but they all have very powerful effects combined when you put them all together.
Heather Boucher is the executive director and chief economist at the Washington Center for Equitable Growth. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. We're talking about leaps on this show, and earlier this week, the European Union took a big one, a leap of faith in order to stimulate Europe's economy. It's announced it's going to start something called quantitative easing, and this is a big deal for Europe, firstly because, unlike the U.S., it's held off on doing it for so long, and secondly because a lot of people in Europe are against it. Patty Hirsch is the host of Marketplace's Whiteboard series, and he's our resident explainer. Hi, Patty.
Hello, Lizzie.
You are always here to explain things to us. So we're going to make a leap of sorts in a second. But first, terminology.
Mm.
Explain quantitative easing. People have heard it here, but break it down.
Quantitative easing is basically buying lots and lots and lots of bonds. So what's going to happen is the European Central Bank is going to buy trillions of dollars worth of bonds from different governments, like all of their sovereign debt. And it's going to buy these bonds in the hope that it's going to drive their interest rates down at these various economies. And what it's then hoping will happen is that because interest rates are low, people are either going to not put their money in the bank and spend it, or banks are going to be able to lend that money out at a relatively low rate so people can borrow it and then spend it, and that will juice the economy.
We're familiar with this in the US, but why is this such a big leap for Europe right now?
Because it's taken them so long to get around to it. I mean, we've been doing it in the US for years. The UK's been doing it. The Japanese have been doing it. Everyone's been like, when are you going to do it, Europe? Your economy is an absolute nightmare. You're suffering deflation at the moment. It's a nightmare for you guys. Would you hurry up and do quantitative easing? Or at least some people are saying that. Some people are saying you shouldn't do quantitative easing. But those who are arguing for it have been saying, how has it taken you so long? And now a lot of people reckon it is too little, too late.
So what's the hope of, you know, what might happen because of all this?
Well, obviously the hope is that it's going to make this money cheaper to borrow in all of these economies, especially the stricken ones like, you know, France and Italy and Spain. And the hope is that, you know, as people get more money in their pockets through either borrowing it or not saving the money that they otherwise would have saved, they're hoping that they're going to spend that, and all of that spending power is going to like drive inflation up a little bit, which is going to help with wage inflation, so people are going to earn more and the economy is going to be strengthened and reinvigorated by all of this cash flowing through it and people buying stuff and people making stuff, and the economy will, you know, regain the steady stream of success that it had back in sort of 2004, 2005.
I hear a little skepticism in your voice, Mr. Hirsch. Lay out the counter argument.
Well, you know, think of me as a German, okay? My name is Hirsch. It is a German name. And the Germans, for the most part, are not happy about the idea of quantitative easing. Firstly, the Germans are very worried about inflation, you know, thanks to Weimar, right? They're worried that they're going to, this quantitative easing could cause inflation.
A long hangover there.
Right. And, you know, people are going to be wheeling wheelbarrows of money down to get, you know, the croissant and coffee first thing in the morning. That's one of the things they're worried about. I'm not too worried about that. But what I am worried about is moral hazard, all right? You know, you've got bond investors who will now quite happily invest in economies that are not doing well, you know, such as Spain and Italy and even France, the countries that have these systemic problems. And they're going to be saying, well, we'll just invest in these because it's going to be money good, because the ECB is just going to buy those bonds anyway. It's all going to be good, and they're not going to want to let them fail. There's that. There's also this thing called the mutualization of risk, right? Which means
what is that?
Right, it's a cracker, right? So mutualization of risk is basically saying that because the ECB is buying all of these bonds, it basically makes the bonds of Italy or Spain, troubled economies, Portugal, as good as the bonds from Germany, which is obviously in way better shape. That's the mutualization of risk. It's basically flattening risk out across the Eurozone, which is absolutely dead wrong. That should absolutely not happen, because it's not appropriate for people to value debt issued by Portugal in the same way that they value debt issued by Germany, or certainly not
because
at the same
rate. Just, you know, unequally risky economies.
They're absolutely unequally risky economies. Germany's a far better bet than Portugal.
So if you're watching this from the US, what does it mean?
Yeah, I mean, it looks like a lot of Sturm und Drang, right? But the fact is that the European Union is still one of our biggest trading partners. Okay, exports are about 15% of US GDP. Exports to the European Union are about 15% of that. So it's not huge, but it is pretty significant. I mean, that's a big chunk of our exports. So if Europe just goes into complete turmoil, the worry is that, you know, the dollar is going to get even stronger, which means that Europeans aren't going to want to buy stuff that we make, right? So all that stuff we export, they're not going to want it. And by the way, exports also means the stuff that Europeans buy when they come to America. So if tourism collapses, because it's too expensive to come to the US, they're not even going to buy stuff here, which is, it's a real problem for people who are in the tourism business, especially in places like Florida. So there are some big worries for certain sectors of the economy. The other thing we have to worry about is that if Europe collapses, there are big political ramifications as well. And who knows what problems that could cause for the US there.
Well, if they do, we'll have you back on and you can explain them. Patty Hirsch, senior editor at Marketplace and the host of our Whiteboard series. Thank you so much.
It's a pleasure, Lizzie. Thank you.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend, where the economy collides with real life. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. We're going to stay in Europe for one more story about leaps. Greek voters are about to make a big one, maybe, with their national election on Sunday. Polls suggest that the hard-left party Syriza is in the lead, and it wants to end the austerity measures, so cuts to public spending and benefits that were imposed by the government over the last few years. Syriza also wants to renegotiate the terms of the bailout that Greece got from the IMF and its European creditors. It's quite a jump from the current government, which has basically played nice with the creditors. Marketplace's Stephen Beard is in Athens, and he joins us now. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Lizzie.
You're in Greece, and, you know, it really has been the poster child, if you will, for the Eurozone crisis. If you could paint us a picture of what things look like now. You've spent a fair amount of time reporting there. How does it feel today?
It's calmer now than it was. No question about that. The place used to be absolutely boiling with rage, violent protests erupting regularly in the streets. That's gone. Now there's a, you know, sort of air of resignation. Some of the figures are just extraordinary. Unemployment, 27%, more than 50% for young people. 30% of the population live below the official poverty line. I met one of the statistics in person, a casualty of the crisis, Christina, a single mother. She lost her cleaning job and she lives on the equivalent of $50 a month welfare. She doesn't speak English, but this is what she told me. She said, my troubles began with the crisis. I couldn't find work because there were so many other people that were unemployed. Her neighbours used to help her out with money and food, but they're struggling too, so they can't help her quite so much. I asked her how she was going to vote and who she was going to vote for, and she said, I'm not sure. I hope God guides me to vote for someone who will help the people. We are suffering and cannot take it anymore. That's Christina, one of the 30% of Greeks living below the poverty line.
Does this election mean that Greece could turn around and say, forget it, we don't want to live under these austerity measures anymore, and we're just going to say, you know, kind of thumbs at the eurozone? Could they leap out of the eurozone?
Well, the front runner in the polls is Syriza, a radical far-left party, which is indeed promising to roll back some of the austerity, some of the spending cuts, and renegotiate the terms of the $280 billion bailout. The bailout money was lent by other European countries, the taxpayers of other European countries, predominantly the biggest, most powerful economy, Germany. Greeks do not feel that they're ripping off the Germans, however, or that they're asking them for charity. As Dimitrios Papadimitriadis, a psychiatrist who lives and practices here in Athens, explained to me, Greeks are looking for what they call family solidarity.
We believe the debt has to be shared among our European partners. Being part of a European family means taking care of each other, being there for each other. And this is what family is all about.
Stephen, let's run with this family metaphor a bit. I have a sense that the family members on the lending end are maybe a little less sanguine about this.
Yeah, the Germans in particular are very cool on the idea. In fact, there were some government sources that were quoted earlier this month saying that if Syriza wins the election, if Syriza then tries to unpick the terms of the bailout, Greece's departure from the eurozone is inevitable. Now, Syriza's reaction to that is the Germans are bluffing. Mm. They wouldn't like to see Greece expelled. And anyway, according to the party's chief economic advisor, a guy called Yanis Milios, Germany and the rest of the EU should not ride roughshod over the democratically expressed will of the Greek people.
Europe is a continent of democracy. When the people of one country decide to change course, to change policy, then this is something that has to be respected by all parties.
Fiscal hardliners, especially in Germany, I imagine, might find that justification for not paying your debts a little hard to swallow.
Well, this, I think, raises the question of the eurozone and the single currency, which is, why do the Greeks still want to be a part of it if their leading party is objecting to the loan terms from the IMF, the ECB, etc., and actual Greeks seem to really be chafing at a lot of these austerity measures?
Yes, I mean, it is a real paradox. It's a contradiction. It's a badge of pride for them. They feel they belong to this kind of inner group of European countries. They feel intensely European.
So when we put all of this in a larger context, we're watching a small country within the eurozone struggle here. What does this mean if you're sitting in America or if you're trying to watch the Greek election and figure out, well, how does this impact me?
Well, it's a good question because this is a very small country. But it does matter to the rest of the eurozone. It matters to the US too, because countries aren't supposed to leave the eurozone. This currency union is supposed to be permanent. So if a country does, however small, there's going to be intense speculation about which country is next. We're talking here about the world's second biggest currency. If it fell apart, it would be a financial earthquake off the scale.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard reporting for us in Athens. Thank you so much, Stephen.
Thank you, Lizzie.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. You may have heard on the news or the internet about a very, very small leap that's coming. It's the leap second. Yeah, not year, second. On June 30th, all clocks around the world will add 1 second to their time. Why? Well, the short version is that it brings clocks into sync with the movement of the Earth. For centuries, we've measured time based on how the Earth revolves around the sun. But the way our planet moves is it's kind of weird. Earth wobbles, and sometimes solar time strays from the much more precise human-made measurement, atomic time. The solution is every few years, add or subtract a second on atomic clocks to bring everything back into alignment. And do we care that there's an extra second? Not really. But the machines and computers that run our economy do. And when all of a sudden there's an extra second in a minute, a computing clock's entire world can be thrown out of whack. We wanted to learn more about what leap seconds and atomic clocks actually do for us. So we sent producer Eliza Mills to NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California. Hi, Eliza.
Hi, Lizzie.
So tell me about where you went, what you saw, and what are they building there?
Well, basically, they're building really, really serious clocks.
Okay.
NASA wants to send clocks into deep space to improve navigation systems, communications between spacecraft. I spoke to Robert Cielker. He's heading up their deep space atomic clock mission there. And they've been really thinking about the leap second at JPL, because for companies dealing with navigation, that teeny tiny second is actually a really big deal.
So atomic clocks on the GPS satellites, of course, have to be very reliable and have to be very accurate, because you're basically building a navigation system that is used everywhere on the Earth. Similar in space, we could not track our spacecraft if we didn't accommodate the leap second.
The atomic clocks at JPL are used to pinpoint spacecraft and communicate over vast distances quickly. And that helps NASA map new areas of deep space.
There are no signposts when you travel in deep space. And so the only mechanism really for navigation is by sending signals back and forth between the Earth and the spacecraft. And frequency and timing are the calibration points which make that possible.
So, okay, when there's a second off, what happens?
Well, there really isn't ever a second off for NASA. In 2012, the last leap second year, a lot of computer networks had problems, things like Java that didn't really accommodate the extra time. But this is a really, really intense clock, even though it's pretty small.
So in this room, you are surrounded by many different types of atomic frequency standards. And the Deep Space Atomic Clock for the technology demonstration mission is in this chamber here. You can see it through the wall. It's that object about the size of a shoebox, that large shoebox sitting in the middle of that coil system.
So this metal shoebox thing, it actually contains one of the most accurate clocks in the universe, right?
Once it's attached to a spacecraft, it will communicate through radio frequencies with bigger atomic clocks on Earth. And together, they're very accurate. The master clock that Cielker showed me at the lab here in California is massive, probably 8 feet tall and 4 feet wide.
This box here, this is what we call the master clock. Now, it's receiving a frequency input from a very stable atomic frequency standard. So this is the equivalent of the face of your grandfather clock, which shows the dial and reads it out to something we can relate to. It is in this box that we will introduce the leap second. In fact, you can see it's built in right here on this panel. There's a leap second add and subtract feature. There's no lights flashing yet. We haven't programmed it. We have to enter two touch keys here to enter in the leap second. So this system was carefully designed to accommodate the leap second.
So it seems like it's one thing for NASA to deal with the leap second, and it works. You know, when companies plan ahead, Google was fine in 2012. They kind of space it out over a while. But there still seems to be a lot of criticism about this whole leap second system and worries that it could cause some real problems.
The main concern when it comes to timekeeping and the leap second is transparency. It's not necessarily the leap second throwing computer systems off, it's preparedness.
Oh.
And there's a proposal to abolish the leap second altogether.
This was an arbitrary definition based upon international agreements. It is just a construct of time, just as time zones are, daylight savings time, the actual offset of time is relative. And the main goal of time synchronization is that everybody's clocks are ticking together.
So it sounds like until we can all agree to get rid of the leap second, we'll just keep adding tiny leaps every few years. Our thanks to Robert Teelker at JPL. And of course, Eliza, thank you.
Thanks, Lizzie.
Now let's go from atomic clocks to the machines that use them. Technology makes leaps at an almost exponential rate. How that's happened can tell us a lot about an industry and teach us lessons about creativity and innovation. So how are technological leaps made? And what are the next ones going to be?
Today, we're going to be showing our friends the basics of technology. This is Tech in Real Life.
Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Lizzie.
This week on the show, we're talking about leaps, and we have you in here to talk about leaps in technology. Let's spin this forward. We're going to be talking about the future, but the past few years, we're on an exponential curve here.
Absolutely. I mean, so Moore's Law, you've heard of, I'm sure. This is something we talk about a lot on Marketplace Tech, invented by Gordon Moore. He's the co-founder of Intel. The idea is that the number of transistors per square inch on integrated circuits has doubled every year since the invention of
these kinds of circuits. So we're talking exponential growth.
Yeah. And, you know, actually, there's some debate about this now. People are talking about how maybe this is slowing down. But at least in recent years, this has impacted technology a ton because it's meant that early computers, for instance, that filled up entire rooms, entire buildings, could become small enough to fit on a desk at home. But also, the biggest leap that consumers are still feeling from Moore's Law, I think, is that we're all carrying computers in our pockets and our purses, right? The mobile internet-connected device has been a huge leap in our lives.
We're talking about more than Moore's Law.
So to speak, right?
I mean, this has done more than put, you know, a tiny mobile computer in my pocket or my purse.
Right. I mean, it's more complicated than that. The spread of not just cell phones, but smartphones and the resulting competition among device makers has driven prices of smartphones and cell phones way down. There's more competition in the companies that actually that deliver the internet wirelessly to these devices. And the size of the internet itself has really exploded with the advent of mobile devices. As way more people come online, that means a lot more knowledge sharing too, a lot more products, collaboration, even just the economy of ideas makes a huge leap, I think, as we see smartphones spread to new markets.
Let's take the leap idea further. We all want to know what's coming next. What are the things that are going to change our lives in the future?
Everybody loves to talk about the Internet of Things, where all of our devices will be online and we'll be able to talk to each other. You know, your Wi-Fi is going to connect to your refrigerator and your toaster and your television, et cetera, et cetera.
Tell me when car. I'm on eggs, et cetera.
Exactly. And I actually think that I'm a little bit skeptical of this idea, Lizzie, because in my mind, a lot of this technology, you really need to make a strong argument for the consumer to really see it spread. And I don't think we're quite there yet with the Internet of Things.
All right. So you think there are other things, bigger things coming next. What are they?
I think that virtual reality is going to happen sooner. This is because I actually, you know, I don't know, call me a nerd, but I just think that this has more potential for the consumer because we love entertainment. And virtual reality has, you know, some amazing possibilities when it comes to entertainment. Now, Oculus, this company I'm sure you've heard of, owned by Facebook now, the reviews of the latest Oculus devices are pretty glowing. People are really excited about this. It's a set of goggles that you put over your face, and it has this 360-degree feel to whatever you see. You've got a screen in front of your eyes, and you can look down and see, you know, whatever virtual reality is below you. You can look up. You can look behind you. People are like really excited about this. Also, this past week, Microsoft just kind of blew people's minds as it announced its new Windows 10 operating system by announcing this product called the HoloLens. And this is a little bit different from virtual reality. So instead of actually cutting off the real world and giving you this 360-degree environment, the HoloLens actually projects holograms into the room that you're in and the room that you're seeing. So you and I could be sitting in this room together, Lizzie, and we could be looking at that blank wall over there, and there could be a giant TV screen playing on it if we are wearing the HoloLens.
If I'm not someone who plays video games, mm-hmm. what's the argument for me to buy it?
Well, do you talk to your mom?
Yes. Probably not as often as she'd like, but yes.
So imagine you and your mom actually can put these things on and interact with each other in a really sort of more powerful visual way. Maybe you can sit in your apartment on your bed and you could have one of these HoloLenses on. And because of that, you could see a holographic projection of your mother sitting on the couch in your apartment, even though she's sitting in Washington, D.C.
Ben, these headsets, Oculus Rift, for example, how much money are we talking about for the consumer?
These headsets can cost anywhere from $200 to actually $1,500.
Whoa.
This is early days, we should say, and these are developers' kits. So they're kits for people to actually make content. And actually, interestingly,
So for a consumer, it could be more in the $200, $400 range?
Yeah. And I think actually what's interesting about this is that the biggest hurdle for virtual reality at this point is content. We just don't have the movies, the games, the shopping experiences yet that these companies want us to have for it to be actually become popular in the consumer environment.
It's another leap. Ben Johnson, host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life. Thank you.
Thank you, Lizzie.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend, where the economy collides with real life. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. You know those phrases I used at the top of the show, like leap of faith or take a leap? A lot of you have done that. And last week, we asked you to tell us about those financial leaps. Many of you wrote in by visiting marketplaceweekend.org. Linda Saylor from Chicago got laid off and continued to do what she loved by starting a nonprofit farm. Billy Warden from Raleigh, North Carolina, wrote to tell us about his big leap into his own marketing business. He told us, quote, "It was terrifying at times." And Kay Baltz told us her leap came after an unexpected divorce, leaving her on her own for the first time. She never had to worry about managing finances before. Without a job or a college degree, Kay had to learn fast.
I know it's kind of a cliche, but the rug was just pulled out from underneath me. I had no idea what I was going to do. You know, mom and wife just gets you so far. And all of a sudden, I was becoming the college student, the poor college student, the struggling first-year employee. It was a big change from what our life was. The biggest concerns was learning how to get by when money is suddenly an issue. Little things like the way people relate to you, the way you relate to people, yes. I went from being totally dependent on someone else to provide my financial well-being to being capable, educated, and able to provide my own financial well-being.
Thanks to all of you for writing in and telling us your stories. Please keep doing it. We love it, and it makes the show really special. Before we move on, though, we wanted to share one more. Listener Diane Huck made a gigantic leap, one of identity. After 19 years, she left her life as a nun and began a new one, almost from scratch. She spoke to us from St. Louis, Missouri.
It brought about a lot of different feelings because, yes, it was a very dramatic change. Some fear. There was, you know, some hesitancy, but there was also some excitement and adventure. Was I this, you know, cloistered, locked up person that didn't have anything to say about my life? Religious communities are not this stereotypical thing that people think of from, you know, 50, 60, 100 years ago. It wasn't that, you know, that different from the way people live. It was just that I was part of a different kind of a family. It's been, about 22 years now since I made my leap to start this new stage in my life. I'm very happy. I have a really wonderful life. I have friends. I have a work that I enjoy. I am very happy being single. You know, I have certainly thought about over the years if marriage was something that I wanted to pursue, and I have just never felt drawn to that. When it came to having to get myself established financially, even though it was something I'd really never had to do before, somehow I knew enough to get started. It's true that when I was in the community, I didn't have to personally worry about finances because there were people who took care of that for everybody. But I can't say that I miss that. I appreciate what I have. And if anything, it means more to me because I have to manage it all myself and take care of it myself. And so I guess I don't take it for granted as I might have before. What's most important is that I know who I am.
On next week's show, what goes up must come down or hit a brick wall. We're talking crashes. And if you have a story about a time your personal economy crashed, tell us. What happened? How did you make it through? You can let us know by visiting marketplaceweekend.org or on Twitter. We're at MarketplaceWKND. You can also drop us a line on Marketplace's Facebook page. Starting a small business is one leap many people aspire to. It's risky, it's scary, but for a lot of people, it's liberating. Susan Hamersky is someone who made that leap. She opened a business with her husband in Los Angeles called California Concierge. But she didn't do it alone. She has a coach.
On your mark, get set, go. I'm Don Donner, a native Angeleno.
Don is with SCORE Greater Los Angeles. That's a mentoring organization for small business owners. We brought Don and Susan in to talk about some of the finer points of making the leap into entrepreneurship. Don is an entrepreneur himself. In fact, he knew what he wanted to do in 1941 at age 14 while watching the owner of the service station where he worked in his first job.
And the owner smoked Havana cigars. So I said, boy, this is a business I'd like to be in. And that was my beginning of my dream. I got into the cooker, as we called it, meaning I got into the heat and fire and owned my own service station. Fast forward, Susan, why did you want to start your business?
Life with three small children was very hectic, and we used to often joke that we didn't have any time to just enjoy the life that we were working so hard for. And we used to always say, there ought to be somebody we could pay to just do our errands and do all this stuff that we don't want to take time away from the more important things to do. We kind of grew from the idea of there ought to be a service like this to then it became, we can create a service like this.
Okay, the first thing I asked Susan, did you have any kind of plan, any type of format of how you were going to conduct your business?
We did not have a clue about starting a business.
They haven't got a clue. And truthfully, I never had a plan when I opened up my service station.
We naively thought that, oh, people will just come running to us. They'll want our services. And we sat around for a long time, and it was very difficult. We were thinking, what are we doing wrong? We don't know what we're doing. And work would trickle in, but we just never were really picking up steam until 2002.
And I met Susan Hamersky in 2002.
And has helped me for many years build the business that I have today.
Step by step. There's no easy way to do a business plan.
Some of the things that I learned from Don, we didn't know the amount of time that it would consume.
When you go to a restaurant, all you see is 10%. You don't see 90% of what happens to make a restaurant successful. So
when you start your own business, you think you're your own boss, and you are, but really, on another level, your client becomes your boss.
You have to prove to them that as far as you're concerned, they're the only people alive.
And sometimes that meant calling on a good friend at the last moment to drop off the kids with because our youngest was not in kindergarten yet.
When you're in business for yourself, it's 24/7. You're always thinking of ideas, but you have a family. So you have to set apart certain amount of time to do what you're doing. So you project what you're going to accomplish each and every day.
In 2009, it was just at the start of the big recession, we decided to change up our pricing structure. And we went to a membership-based pricing structure rather than just a strictly hourly-based. And this involved quite a large jump in price to our clients. So I thought of the quality that we're providing to them and remembered what Don said.
Whatever you're selling, you'd bet your life on it.
And we went forward with that new pricing structure and never looked back. And that has been a huge, huge turning point in our business.
That's quite a leap.
We have come a long way, a lot of it with Don's help. And I think of one phrase he used to keep repeating to me, something along the lines of, quality is long remembered when price is soon forgot. Is that correct, Don?
My late mother, at her funeral, there were over 300 people telling me what a wonderful human being she was to the community. And that stayed with me. That warmed the cockles of my heart. So if you give, you receive. People like Susan Rimersky and her husband are the living proof that a little bit of help can make things happen in their life to realize their dream.
That was business owner Susan Rimersky and business coach Don Donner talking in our LA studios. You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. Throughout the show, we've been talking about leaps, both small ones and big ones. Now, let's get global. Last year, the world experienced a significant jump, a rise in global temperature. Turns out, 2014 was the hottest year on record. And just this week, a group of scientists moved the hands on the doomsday clock. That's when mankind wipes out our own existence at midnight, to 11:57 p.m. That's the closest the clock has been to midnight since the height of the Cold War. And one of the reasons the scientists cited is climate change. But it's hard to get people to act differently, especially when the consequences for inaction can seem so far off in the future. Ann Carlson is the co-director of the Emmett Institute on Climate Change and the Environment at UCLA Law. And I asked her how to make people actually change their behavior.
So one of the things I think we really need when you want to talk about leaps are big leaps in innovative technology that can produce energy without the consequent greenhouse gas emissions.
How do you get different actors to do that? I mean, where does the incentive come from? Where does the money come from?
Well, the incentive, I think, comes from pricing. So either through a tax or through a cap and trade system that says to emitters, you can't emit unless you pay a price for those emissions. And then the money comes from entrepreneurs, innovators who figure out how to develop energy that doesn't emit as many emissions or that captures those emissions. So one of the things we're seeing in areas of the country where we've been pretty aggressive on trying to reduce greenhouse gas emissions is actually the creation of a lot of jobs in industries that are producing clean energy.
Can you give me some examples?
Yeah, so a big example is solar. So there are a lot of incentives around the country to require utilities to generate a lot of their electricity or to buy the generation of electricity from clean sources like solar and wind. Solar is now starting to be competitive with more traditional carbon-intensive fuels like coal and natural gas. We're now seeing more jobs in the solar industry than we are in the coal industry.
There's this sort of dichotomy between what the government has pushed for and can agree on Certainly cap and trade has gone nowhere on Capitol Hill versus what private businesses are doing. Who is funding these changes now?
Well, the funding is coming from a couple different sources. One thing that's spurring private businesses is actually regulation in places like California. The Department of Energy, through the stimulus bill in 2008, actually funded quite a bit of research and provided loans. You may remember the Solyndra fiasco, right? Now, so it turns out that the government lost money on Solyndra but made a lot of money on a lot of other green technology investments. So there have been a number of sources. Then in addition, there have been these regulatory requirements, which are not direct money but are mandates that say to a company, for example, an auto company, you need to meet a certain standard for your cars or you can't sell them or you're going to get fined. And so there have been a bunch of different mechanisms. Then there have also been other countries around the world that have been very aggressive in promoting green energy. The European Union, and particularly Germany, has been really, really aggressive in trying to get its economy moving toward a very, very carbon neutral economy using a lot of wind and solar. And their usage has driven prices down. So, again, made some of this green energy cheaper and more competitive with traditional sources like coal and natural gas.
You know, I think about the way we talk about these issues, and I'm holding part of the report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and I just want to read part of it to you. It says, "Continued emission of greenhouse gases will cause further warming and long-lasting changes in all components of the climate system, increasing the likelihood of severe, pervasive, and irreversible impacts for people and ecosystems." That seems pretty clear, even for a bunch of scientists. So I guess I wonder, what's the gap between hearing that and how do you leap to, you know, I might need to actually change the stuff I'm doing?
Well, I think, again, there are a couple of gaps. One is that it really is a global problem. And it's really easy to say, well, the U.S. isn't going to act too aggressively unless we see China acting aggressively. And China may say, well, we're really not going to do anything because it's the United States that emitted and Europe. And it's very easy to kind of shift responsibility from one country to another and not actually take action. I think another reason is, again, because most of the gain that we get from reducing carbon emissions today will benefit future generations. That it won't necessarily benefit us immediately. And it's really hard for politicians to take steps that impose current pain in order to provide future benefits. And so the really lengthy nature of this problem contributes to, I think, political inertia.
It also seems like it contributes to personal inertia. Like everybody thinks, well, there's just not that much I can do.
Both of those things are true. You change your behavior and you don't actually see immediate results. With climate change, you stop using as much energy and all you notice is that you're not using as much energy. You don't see temperatures drop, right? You don't see immediate effects of something like cleaner air. And that's true for politicians too. So even if you reduce the emissions, you might see some gains in job growth in green tech industries, but you don't see an immediate effect in reducing the environmental problem. Frankly, I am not a believer that we can just call on people's goodwill to engage in behavioral change in a way to solve the problem. I think we need regulatory policy that incentivizes people to change their behavior. And probably the best way to do that is by, again, making people pay for the social costs of burning fuel that puts carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. I'm a believer that price can do a lot. I think the best example of that is see what happens when gasoline prices go up. When gasoline prices go up, people buy smaller cars, they drive less, they carpool more, they change their behavior, not because they're trying to save the environment, because they're trying to save some money.
Ann Carlson is the Shapiro Professor of Environmental Law and the Faculty Director of the Emmett Institute on Climate Change and the Environment at the UCLA School of Law. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And that's our show for this week. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Jenny Ament and Eliza Mills. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer, and Charlton Thorpe is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. Next week, we're talking about crashes. personal, financial, and yeah, maybe some of that global meltdown stuff. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening. This is APM.